That probably wouldn't happen, but we can't take the chance.
How long's a while?
Maybe a month. John considered this, then sighed.
Maybe even two.
Give his folks that long to go on thinking he might just have run off. Give them that long before we break their hearts. He shook his head. If I'd had to look at his face, I don't think I ever could have slept again.
You'd be surprised what a person can live with, Dan said. He was thinking of Mrs. Massey, now safely stored away in the back of his head, her haunting days over. He started the car, powered down his window, and beat the baseball glove several times against the door to dislodge the dirt. Then he put it on, sliding his fingers into the places where the child's had been on so many sunlit afternoons. He closed his eyes. After 30 seconds or so, he opened them again.
Anything?
You're Barry. You're one of the good guys.
What does that mean?
I don't know, except I'm betting he's the one Abra calls Barry the Chunk.
Nothing else?
Abra will be able to get more.
Are you sure of that?
Dan thought of the way his vision had sharpened when Abra opened her eyes inside his head.
I am. Shine your light on the pocket of the glove for a sec, will you? There's something written there.
John did it, revealing a child's careful printing.
Tomy, 2-5.
What does that mean? John asked. I thought his name was Trevor.
Jim Tomy's a baseball player. His number is 25. He stared into the pocket of the glove for a moment, then laid it gently on the seat between them. He was that kid's favorite major leaguer. He named his glove after him. I'm gonna get these fuckers. I swear before God Almighty, I'm going to get them and make them sorry.
14.
Rose the Hat shone. The entire true shone, but not in the way Dan or Billy did. Neither Rose nor Crow had any sense, as they said their goodbyes, that the child they had taken years ago in Iowa was at that moment being uncovered by two men who knew far too much about them already. Rose could have caught the communications flying between Dan and Abra if she had been in a state of deep meditation, but of course then the little girl would have noticed her presence immediately. Besides, the goodbyes going on in Rose's Earth Cruiser that night were of an especially intimate sort. She lay with her fingers laced together behind her head and watched Crow dress.
You visited that store, right?
District X.
Not me personally. I have a reputation to protect. I sent Jimmy numbers. Crow grinned as he buckled his belt. He could have gotten what we needed in 15 minutes, but he was gone for 2 hours. I think Jimmy's found a new home.
Well, that's good. I hope you boys enjoy yourselves. Trying to keep it light. But after 2 days of mourning, Grandpa Flick, climaxed by the circle of farewell, keeping anything light was an effort.
He didn't get anything that compares to you.
She raised her eyebrows. Had a preview, did you, Henry?
Didn't need one. He eyed her as she lay naked with her hair spread out in a dark fan. She was tall, even lying down. He had ever liked tall women.
You're the featured attraction in my home theater, and always will be.
Overblown. Just a bit of Crow's patented razzle-dazzle, but it pleased her just the same. She got up and pressed against him, her hands in his hair. Be careful. Bring everyone back, and bring her.
We will.
Then you better get a wiggle on.
Relax. We'll be in Sturbridge when Easy Mail Services opens on Friday morning. In New Hampshire by noon. By then, Barry will have located her.
As long as she doesn't locate him.
I'm not worried about that.
Fine, Rose thought. I'll worry for both of us. I'll worry until I'm looking at her wearing cuffs on her wrists and clamps on her ankles.
The beauty of it, Crow said, is that if she does sense us and tries to put up an interference wall, Barry will key on that.
If she's scared enough, she might go to the police.
He flashed a grin.
You think? Yes, little girl, they'd say. We're sure these awful people are after you. So tell us if they're from outer space or just your ordinary garden variety zombies. That way we'll know what to look for.
Don't joke, and don't take this lightly. Get in clean and get out the same way. That's how it has to be. No outsiders involved. No innocent bystanders. Kill the parents if you need to. Kill anyone who tries to interfere. But keep it quiet.
Crow snapped off a comic salute. Yes, my captain.
Get out of here, idiot. But give me another kiss first. Maybe a little of that educated tongue for good measure. He gave her what she asked for. Rose held him tight, and for a long time.
15.
Dan and John rode in silence most of the way back to the motel in Adair. The spade was in the trunk. The baseball glove was in the back seat wrapped in a Holiday Inn towel. At last John said,
"We've got to bring Abra's folks into this now. She's going to hate it, and Lucy and David won't want to believe it, but it has to be done."
Dan looked at him straight-faced and said, "What are you, a mind reader?" John wasn't, but Abra was, and her sudden loud voice in Dan's head made him glad that this time John was driving. If he had been behind the wheel, they very likely would have ended up in some farmer's corn patch.
No!
Abra, he spoke aloud so that John could hear at least his half of the conversation. Abra, listen to me.
No, Dan! They think I'm all right. They think I'm almost normal now.
Honey, if these people had to kill your mom and dad to get to you, do you think they'd hesitate?
I sure don't.
Not after what we found back there. There was no counter-argument she could make to this, and Abra didn't try. But suddenly Dan's head was filled with her sorrow and her fear. His eyes welled up again and spilled tears down his cheeks. Shit. 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 Shit.
16. Early Thursday morning. Steamhead Steve's Winnebago, with Snakebite Andy currently behind the wheel, was cruising eastbound on I-80 in western Nebraska at a perfectly legal 65 miles an hour. The first streaks of dawn had just begun to show on the horizon. In Anniston, it was 2 hours later. Dave Stone was in his bathrobe, making coffee when the phone rang. It was Lucy, calling from Conchetta's Marlborough Street condo. She sounded like a woman who had nearly reached the end of her resources.
If nothing changes for the worse, although I guess that's the only way things can change now, they'll be releasing Momo from the hospital first thing next week. I talked with the two doctors on her case last night.
Why didn't you call me, sweetheart?
Too tired and too depressed. I thought I'd feel better after a night's sleep, but I didn't get much. Honey, this place is just so full of her. Not just her work, her vitality.
Her voice wavered. David waited. They had been together for over 15 years, and he knew that when Lucy was upset, waiting was sometimes better than talking.
I don't know what we're going to do with it all. Just looking at the books makes me tired. There are thousands on the shelves and stacked in her study. And the super says there are thousands more in storage.
We don't have to decide right now.
He says there's also a trunk marked Alessandra. That was my mother's real name, you know. Although I guess she always called herself Sandra or Sandy. I never knew Momo had her stuff.
For someone who let it all hang out in her poetry, Chetta could be one closed-mouthed lady when she wanted to.
Lucy seemed not to hear him. Only continued in the same dull, slightly nagging, tired-to-death tone.
Everything's arranged, although I'll have to reschedule the private ambulance if they decide to let her go Sunday. They said they might. Thank God she's got good insurance. That goes back to her teaching days at Tufts, you know. She never made a dime from poetry. Who in this fucked-up country would pay a dime to read it anymore?
Lucy?
She's got a good place in the main building at Rivington House, a little suite. I took the online tour, not that she'll be using it long. I made friends with the head nurse on her floor here, and she says Momo's just about at the end of her. Chia, I love you, honey. That, Conchetta's old nickname for her, finally stopped her. With all my admittedly non-Italian heart and soul. I know, and thank God you do. This has been so hard, but it's almost over. I'll be there Monday at the very latest.
We can't wait to see you.
How are you? How's Abra?
We're both fine. David would be allowed to go on believing this for another 60 seconds or so. He heard Lucy yawn.
I might go back to bed for an hour or two. I think I can sleep now.
You do that. I've got to get Abs up for school.
They said their goodbyes, and when Dave turned away from the kitchen wall phone, he saw that Abra was already up. She was still in her pajamas. Her hair was every which way, her eyes were red, and her face was pale. She was clutching Hoppy, her old stuffed rabbit.
Abadou? Honey? Are you sick?
Yes, no. I don't know. But you will be when you hear what I'm going to tell you. I need to talk to you, Daddy. And I don't want to go to school today. Tomorrow either. Maybe not for a while, she hesitated. I'm in trouble.
The first thing that phrase brought to mind was so awful that he pushed it away at once, but not before Abra caught it. She smiled wanly.
No, I'm not pregnant.
He stopped on his way to her, halfway across the kitchen, his mouth falling open.
Did you just...
Yes, she said. I just read your mind. Although anyone could have guessed what you were thinking that time, Daddy. It was all over your face. And it's called shining, not mind-reading. I can still do most of the things that used to scare you when I was little. Not all, but most.
He spoke very slowly.
I know you still sometimes have premonitions. Your mom and I both know.
It's a lot more than that. I have a friend. His name is Dan. He and Dr. John have been in Iowa.
John Dalton?
Yes.
Who's this Dan? Is he a kid Dr. John treats?
No, he's a grown-up.
She took his hand and led him to the kitchen table. There they sat down, Abra still holding Hoppy.
But when he was a kid, he was like me.
Abs, I'm not understanding any of this.
There are bad people, Daddy.
She knew she couldn't tell him they were more than people, worse than people, until Dan and John were here to help her explain.
They might want to hurt me.
Why would anyone want to hurt you? You're not making sense. As for all those things you used to do, if you could still do them, we'd know.
The drawer below the hanging pots flew open, then shut, then opened again. She could no longer lift the spoons, but the drawer was enough to get his attention.
Once I understood how much it worried you guys, how much it scared you, I hid it. But I can't hide it anymore. Dan says I have to tell.
She pressed her face against Hoppy's threadbare fur and began to cry.
Chapter 12. They Call It Steam. 1. John turned on his cell as soon as he and Dan emerged from the jetway at Logan Airport late Thursday afternoon. He had no more than registered the fact that he had well over a dozen missed calls when the phone rang in his hand. He glanced down at the window.
Stone? Dan asked. I've got a lot of missed calls from the same number, so I'd say it has to be.
Don't answer. Call him back when we're on the expressway north and tell him we'll be there by...
Dan glanced at his watch, which he had never changed from Eastern time. By 6. When we get there, we'll tell him everything.
John reluctantly pocketed his cell.
I spent the flight back hoping I'm not going to lose my license to practice over this. Now I'm just hoping the cops don't grab us as soon as we park in front of Dave Stone's house. Dan, who had consulted several times with Abra on their way back across the country, shook his head.
She's convinced him to wait, but there's a lot going on in that family just now, and Mr. Stone is one confused American.
To this, John offered a smile of singular bleakness.
He's not the only one.
2.
Abra was sitting on the front step with her father when Dan swung into the Stones' driveway. They had made good time. It was only 5:30. Abra was up before Dave could grab her and came running down the walk with her hair flying out behind her. Dan saw she was heading for him and handed the towel-wrapped fielder's mitt to John. She threw herself into his arms. She was trembling all over.
"You found him, you found him, and you found the glove. Give it to me."
"Not yet," Dan said, setting her down. "We need to thrash this out with your dad first."
"Thrash what out?" Dave asked. He took Abra by the wrist and pulled her away from Dan. "Who are these bad people she's talking about? And who the hell are you?"
His gaze shifted to John, and there was nothing friendly in his eyes.
"What in the name of sweet Jesus is going on here?"
"This is Dan, Daddy. He's like me. I told you."
John said, "Where's Lucy? Does she know about this?"
"I'm not telling you anything until I find out what's going on."
Abra said,
"She's still in Boston with Momo. Daddy wanted to call her, but I persuaded him to wait until you got here."
Her eyes remained pinned on the towel-wrapped glove.
"Dan Torrance," Dave said. "That's your name?"
"Yes."
"You work at the hospice in Fraser?"
"That's right."
"How long have you been meeting my daughter?"
His hands were clenching and unclenching.
"Did you meet her on the internet? I'm betting that's it."
He switched his gaze to John.
"If you hadn't been Abra's pediatrician from the day she was born, I would have called the police 6 hours ago, when you didn't answer your phone."
"I was in an airplane," John said. "I couldn't."
"Mr. Stone," Dan said, "I haven't known your daughter as long as John has, but almost. The first time I met her, she was just a baby, and it was she who reached out to me."
Dave shook his head. He looked perplexed, angry, and little inclined to believe anything Dan told him.
"Let's go in the house," John said. "I think we can explain everything. Almost everything. And if that's the case, you'll be very happy that we're here, and that we went to Iowa to do what we did."
"I damn well hope so, John. But I've got my doubts."
They went inside, Dave with his arm around Abra's shoulders. At that moment, they looked more like jailer and prisoner than father and daughter. John Dalton next, Dan last. He looked across the street at the rusty red pickup parked there. Billy gave him a quick thumbs up, then crossed his fingers. Dan returned the gesture and followed the others through the front door.
3.
As Dave was sitting down in his Richland Court living room with his puzzling daughter and his even more puzzling guests, the Winnebago containing the true raiding party was southeast of Toledo. Walnut was at the wheel. Andy Steiner and Barry were sleeping, Andy like the dead, Barry rolling from side to side and muttering. Crow was in the parlor area, paging through the New Yorker. The only things he really liked were the cartoons and the tiny ads for weird items like yak fur sweaters, Vietnamese coolie hats, and faux Cuban cigars. Jimmy Numbers plunked down next to him with his laptop in hand.
"I've been combing the net. Had the hack in back with a couple of sites, but can I show you something?"
"How can you surf the net from an interstate highway?"
Jimmy gave him a patronizing smile.
4G connection, baby. This is the modern age."
"If you say so." Crow put his magazine aside. "What have you got?"
"School pictures from Anniston Middle School."
Jimmy tapped the touchpad and a photo appeared. No grainy newsprint job, but a high-res school portrait of a girl in a red dress with puffed sleeves. Her braided hair was chestnut brown, her smile wide and confident.
"Julianne Cross," Jimmy said.
He tapped the touchpad again, and a redhead with a mischievous grin popped up.
Emma Dean.
Another tap, and an even prettier girl appeared. Blue eyes, blonde hair framing her face and spilling over her shoulders. Serious expression, but dimples hinting at a smile.
This one's Abra Stone.
Abra?
Yeah, they name 'em anything these days. Remember when Jane and Mabel used to be good enough for the robes? I read somewhere that Sly Stallone named his kid Sage Moonblood. How fucked up is that?
You think one of these three is Rose's girl?
If she's right about the girl being a young teenager, it just about has to be. Probably Dean or Stone. They're the two who actually live on the street where the little earthquake was, but you can't count the cross girl out completely. She's just around the corner.
Jimmy Numbers made a swirling gesture on the touchpad, and the three pictures zipped into a row. Written below each in curly script was, My School Memories. Crow studied them.
Is anyone going to tip to the fact that you've been filching pictures of little girls off of Facebook or something? Because that sets off all kinds of warning bells in Rubeland.
Jimmy looked offended.
Facebook, my ass. These came from the Fraser Middle School files, pipelined direct from their computer to mine.
He made an unlovely sucking sound.
And guess what? A guy with access to a whole bank of NSA computers couldn't follow my tracks on this one. Who rocks?
You do, Crow said, I guess.
Which one do you think it is?
If I had to pick, Crow tapped Abra's picture. She's got a certain look in her eyes. A steamy look.
Jimmy puzzled over this for a moment, decided it was dirty and guffawed.
Does it help?
Yes. Can you print these pictures and make sure the others have copies? Particularly Barry. He's locator-in-chief on this one.
I'll do it right now. I'm packing a Fujitsu scan snap. Great little on-the-go machine. I used to have the S-1100, but I swapped it when I read in Computer World.
Just do it, okay?
Sure.
Crow picked up the magazine again and turned to the cartoon on the last page, the one where you were supposed to fill in the caption. This week's showed an elderly woman walking into a bar with a bear on a chain. She had her mouth open, so the caption had to be her dialogue. Crow considered carefully, then printed, Okay, which one of you assholes called me a cunt?
Probably not a winner.
The Winnebago rolled on through the deepening evening. In the cockpit, Nut turned on the headlights. In one of the bunks, Barry the Chink turned and scratched at his wrist in his sleep. A red spot had appeared there. 4.
The three men sat in silence while Abra went upstairs to get something in her room. Dave thought of suggesting coffee. They looked tired, and both men needed a shave, but decided he wasn't going to offer either of them so much as a dry saltine until he got an explanation. He and Lucy had discussed what they were going to do when Abra came home someday in the not-too-distant future and announced that a boy had asked her out. But these were men.
Men!
And it seemed that the one he didn't know had been dating his daughter for quite some time.
After a fashion, anyway.
And wasn't that really the question? What sort of fashion? Before any of them could risk starting a conversation that was bound to be awkward and perhaps acrimonious, there came the muted thunder of Abra's sneakers on the stairs. She came into the room with a copy of The Aniston Shopper.
Look at the back page.
Dave turned the newspaper over and grimaced. What's this brown dreck?
Dried coffee grounds. I threw the newspaper in the trash, but I couldn't stop thinking about it, so I fished it out again. I couldn't stop thinking about him.
She pointed to the picture of Bradley Trevor in the bottom row.
And his parents. And his brothers and sisters, if he had them.
Her eyes filled with tears.
He had freckles, Daddy. He hated them. But his mother said they were good luck.
You can't know that, Dave said with no conviction at all.
She knows, John said, and so do you. Get with us on this, Dave. Please, it's important.
I want to know about you and my daughter, Dave said to Dan. Tell me about that.
Dan went through it again, doodling Abra's name in his AA meeting book, the first chalked hello, his clear sense of Abra's presence on the night Charlie Hayes died. I asked if she was the little girl who sometimes wrote on my blackboard. She didn't answer in words, but there was a little run of piano music. Some old Beatles tune, I think.
Dave looked at John. You told him about that?
John shook his head. Dan said, 2 years ago I got a blackboard message from her that said, they are killing the baseball boy. I didn't know what it meant, and I'm not sure Abra did either. That might have been the end of it, but then she saw that. He pointed to the back page of the Aniston Shopper with all those postage stamp portraits. Abra told the rest. When she was done, Dave said,
So you flew to Iowa on a 13-year-old girl's say-so?
A very special 13-year-old girl, John said, with some very special talents.
We thought all that was over, Dave shot Abra an accusing look. Except for a few little premonitions, we thought she outgrew it.
I'm sorry, Daddy.
Her voice was little more than a whisper.
Maybe she shouldn't have to be sorry, Dan said, hoping he didn't sound as angry as he felt. She hid her ability because she knew you and your wife wanted it to be gone. She hid it because she loves you and wanted to be a good daughter. She told you that, I suppose?
We never even discussed it, Dan said. But I had a mother I loved dearly, and because I did the same thing. Abra shot him a look of naked gratitude. As she lowered her eyes again, she sent him a thought, something she was embarrassed to say out loud. She also didn't want her friends to know. She thought they wouldn't like her anymore, that they'd be scared of her. She was probably right about that, too.
Well, let's not lose sight of the major issue, John said. We flew to Iowa, yes. We found the ethanol plant in the town of Freeman, just where Abra said it would be. We found the boy's body and his glove. He wrote the name of his favorite baseball player in the pocket, but his name, Brad Trevor, is written on the strap.
He was murdered. That's what you're saying. By a bunch of wandering lunatics.
They ride in campers and Winnebagos, Abra said. Her voice was low and dreamy. She was looking at the towel-wrapped baseball glove as she spoke. She was afraid of it, and she wanted to put her hands on it. These conflicting emotions came through to Dan so clearly that they made him feel sick to his stomach.
They have funny names, like pirate names.
Almost plaintively, Dave asked, Are you sure the kid was murdered?
The woman in the hat licked his blood off her hands, Abra said. She had been sitting on the stairs. Now she went to her father and put her face against his chest. When she wants it, she has a special tooth. All of them do.
This kid was really like you?
Yes.
Abra's voice was muffled but understandable. He could see through his hand.
What does that mean?
Like when certain pitches would come. He could hit them because his hand saw them first. And when his mother lost something, he'd put his hand over his eyes and look through it to see where the thing was. I think. I don't know that part for sure, but sometimes I use my hand that way.
And that's why they killed him?
I'm sure of it, Dan said.
For what? Some kind of ESP vitamin? Do you know how ridiculous that sounds?
No one replied.
And they know Abra's on to them?
They know.
She raised her head. Her cheeks were flushed and wet with tears.
They don't know my name or where I live, but they know there is a me.
Then we need to go to the police, Dave said. Or maybe, I guess we'd want the FBI in a case like this. They might have trouble believing it at first, but if the body's there,
Dan said. I won't tell you that's a bad idea until we see what Abra can do with the baseball glove, but you need to think pretty carefully about the consequences for me, for John, for you and your wife, and most of all, for Abra.
I don't see what kind of trouble you and John could possibly...
John shifted impatiently in his chair. Come on, David. Who found the body? Who dug it up and then buried it again after taking a piece of evidence the forensics people would no doubt consider vital? Who brought that piece of evidence halfway across the country so an eighth grader could use it like a Ouija board?
Although he hadn't meant to, Dan joined in.
They were ganging up, and in other circumstances he might have felt bad about that, but not in these.
Your family's already in crisis, Mr. Stone. Your grandmother-in-law is dying. Your wife's grieving and exhausted. This thing will hit the newspapers and the internet like a bomb. Wandering clan of murderers versus a supposedly psychic little girl. They'll want her on TV. You'll say no, and that will just make them hungrier. Your street will turn into an open-air studio. Nancy Grace will probably move in next door. And in a week or two, the whole media mob will be yelling hoax at the top of its lungs. Remember Balloon Boy, Dad? That's apt to be you. Meanwhile, these folks will still be out there.
So who's supposed to protect my little girl if they come after her? You two? A doctor and a hospice orderly? Or are you just a janitor?
You don't even know about the 73-year-old groundskeeper standing watch down the street, Dan thought and had to smile.
I'm a little of both. Look, Mr. Stone, seeing as how you and my daughter are great pals, I guess you better call me Dave.
Okay, Dave it is.
I guess what you do next depends on whether or not you're willing to gamble on law enforcement believing her, especially when she tells them that the Winnebago people are life-sucking vampires.
Christ, Dave said. I can't tell Lucy about this. She'll blow a fuse. All her fuses.
That would seem to answer the question about whether or not to call the police, John remarked.
There was silence for a moment. Somewhere in the house a clock was ticking. Somewhere outside a dog was barking.
The earthquake, Dave said suddenly. That little earthquake. Was that you, Abby?
I'm pretty sure, she whispered.
Dave hugged her, then stood up and took the towel off the baseball glove. He held it, looking it over. They buried him with it, he said. They abducted him, tortured him, murdered him, and then buried him with his baseball glove.
Yes, Dan said.
Dave turned to his daughter. Do you really want to touch this thing, Abra?
She held out her hands and said, No, but give it to me anyway.
5.
David Stone hesitated, then handed it over. Abra took it in her hands and looked into the pocket.
Jim Tomey, she said,
and although Dan would have been willing to bet his savings, after 12 years of steady work and steady sobriety, he actually had some, that she had never encountered the name before, she said it correctly.
Tomey. He's in the 600 Club.
That's right, Dave said.
Hush. Dan said. They watched her. She raised the glove to her face and sniffed the pocket.
Dan, remembering the bugs, had to restrain a wince.
She said, Not Barry the Chunk. Barry the Chink. Only he's not Chinese. They call him that because his eyes slant up at the corners. He's there. There. I don't know. Wait. She held the glove to her chest like a baby. She began to breathe faster. Her mouth dropped open, and she moaned. Dave, alarmed, put a hand on her shoulder. Abra shook him off. No, Daddy, no! She closed her eyes and hugged the glove. They waited. At last her eyes opened, and she said, They're coming for me. Dan got up, knelt beside her, and put one hand over both of hers.
How many is it, some, or is it all of them?
Just some. Barry's with them. That's why I can see. There are 3 others. Maybe 4. One is a lady with a snake tattoo. They call us rubes. We're rubes to them.
Is the woman with the hat?
No.
When will they get here? John asked. Do you know?
Tomorrow. They have to stop first and get... She paused. Her eyes searched the room, not seeing it. One hand slipped out from beneath Dan's and began to rub her mouth. The other clasped the glove.
They have to. I don't know.
Tears began to ooze from the corners of her eyes, not of sadness, but of effort.
Is it medicine? Is it...
Wait, wait, let go of me, Dan. I have to... You have to let me... He took his hand away. There was a brisk snap and a blue flick of static electricity. The piano played a discordant run of notes. On an occasional table by the door to the hall, a number of ceramic Hummel figures were jittering and rapping. Abra slipped the glove on her hand. Her eyes flew wide open.
One is a crow. One is a doctor. And that's lucky for them because Barry is sick. He's sick.
She stared around at them wildly, then laughed. The sound of it made Dan's neck hairs stiffen. He thought it was the way lunatics must laugh when their medication is late. It was all he could do not to snatch the glove off her hand.
He's got the measles.
He's got the measles from Grandpa Flick.
And he'll start to cycle soon.
He was a fucking kid.
He must never have gotten the shot. We have to tell Rose. We have to.
That was enough for Dan. He pulled the glove from her hand and threw it across the room. The piano ceased. The Hummels gave one final clatter and grew still, one of them on the verge of tumbling from the table. Dave was staring at his daughter with his mouth open. John had risen to his feet but seemed incapable of moving any further. Dan took Abra by the shoulders and gave her a hard shake. Abra, snap out of it! She stared at him with huge floating eyes.
Come back, Abra. It's okay.
Her shoulders, which had been almost up to her ears, gradually relaxed. Her eyes were seeing him again. She let out a long breath and fell back against her father's encircling arm. The collar of her T-shirt was dark with sweat.
Abby? Dave asked. Abadou? Are you all right?
Yes, but don't call me that.
She drew in air and let it out in another long sigh.
God, that was intense.
She looked at her father.
I didn't drop the F-bomb, Daddy. That was one of them. I think it was the Crow. He's the leader of the ones who are coming.
Dan sat down beside Abra on the couch. Sure you're okay?
Yes, now. But I never want to touch that glove again. They're not like us. They look like people, and I think they used to be people, but now they have lizardy thoughts.
You said Barry has measles. Do you remember that?
Barry, yes. The one they call the chink. I remember everything. I'm so thirsty.
I'll get you water, John said.
No, something with sugar in it, please.
There are Cokes in the fridge. Dave said.
He stroked Abra's hair, then the side of her face, then the back of her neck, as if to reassure himself that she was still there. They waited until John came back with a can of Coke. Abra seized it, drank greedily, then belched.
Sorry,
she said, and giggled. Dan had never been so happy to hear a giggle in his life.
John, measles are more serious than adults, yes?
You bet. It can lead to pneumonia, even blindness due to corneal scarring.
Death?
Sure, but it's rare.
It's different for them, Abra said, because I don't think they usually get sick. Only Barry is. They're going to stop and get a package. It must be medicine for him, the kind you give in shots.
What did you mean about cycling? Dave asked.
I don't know.
If Barry's sick, will that stop them? John asked. Will they maybe turn around and go back to wherever they came from?
I don't think so. They might already be sick from Barry, and they know it. They have nothing to lose and everything to gain. That's what Crow says.
She drank more Coke, holding the can in both hands, then looked around at each of the other men in turn, ending with her father.
They know my street, and they might know my name, after all. They might even have a picture. I'm not sure. Barry's mind is all messed up, but they think if I can't catch the measles...
Then your essence might be able to cure them, Dan said, or at least inoculate the others.
They don't call it essence, Abra said. They call it steam.
Dave clapped his hands once briskly. That's it. I'm calling the police. We'll have these people arrested.
You can't.
Abra spoke in the dull voice of a depressed 50-year-old woman.
Do what you want, that voice said. I'm only telling you.
He had taken his cell out of his pocket, but instead of opening it, he held it.
Why not?
They'll have a good story for why they're traveling to New Hampshire, and lots of good identity things. Also, they're rich. Really rich. The way banks and oil companies and Walmart are rich. They might go away, but they'll come back. They always come back for what they want. They kill people who get in their way, and people who try to tell on them, and if they need to buy their way out of trouble, that's what they do.
She put her Coke down on the coffee table and put her arms around her father.
Please, Daddy, don't tell anybody. I'd rather go with them than have them hurt Mom or you.
Dan said, but right now, there are only 4 or 5 of them.
Yes.
Where are the rest? Do you know that now?
At a place called the Bluebird Campground. Or maybe it's Bluebell. They own it. There's a town nearby. That's where the supermarket is, the Sam's. The town is called Sidewinder. Rose is there. And the True. That's what they call themselves. Dan? What's wrong?
Dan made no reply. For the moment, at least, he was incapable of speech. He was remembering Dick Halloran's voice coming from Eleanor Ouley's dead mouth. He had asked Dick where the empty devils were, and now the answer made sense. In your childhood.
Dan?
That was John. He sounded far away.
You're as white as a sheet.
It all made a weird kind of sense. He had known from the first, even before he actually saw it, that the Overlook Hotel was an evil place. It was gone now, burned flat, but who was to say the evil had also been burned away? Certainly not him. As a child, he had been visited by revenants who had escaped. This campground they own, it stands where the hotel stood. I know it. And sooner or later I'll have to go back there. I know that too. Probably sooner. But first...
I'm all right, he said.
Want a Coke? Abra said. Sugar solves lots of problems, that's what I think.
Later. I have an idea. It's sketchy, but maybe the 4 of us working together can turn it into a plan.
6. Snakebite Andy parked in the trucker's lot of a turnpike rest area near Westfield, New York. Nut went into the service plaza to get juice for Barry, who was now running a fever and had a painfully sore throat. While they waited for him to come back, Crow put through a call to Rose. She answered on the first ring. He filled her in as quickly as he could, then waited.
"What's that I hear in the background?" she asked.
Crow sighed and rubbed one hand up a stubbled cheek.
"That's Jimmy Numbers. He's crying."
"Tell him to shut up. Tell him there's no crying in baseball."
Crow conveyed this, omitting Rose's peculiar sense of humor. Jimmy, at the moment, wiping Barry's face with a damp cloth, managed to muffle his loud and, Crow had to admit it, annoying sobs.
"That's better,"
Rose said. "What do you want us to do?"
"Give me a second. I'm trying to think."
Crow found the idea of Rose having to try to think almost as disturbing as the red spots that had now broken out all over Barry's face and body, but he did as he was told, holding the iPhone to his ear, but saying nothing. He was sweating. Fever? Or just hot in here? Crow scanned his arms for red blemishes and saw none. Yet.
Are you on schedule? Rose asked.
So far, yes. A little ahead, even.
There was a brisk double rap at the door. Andy looked out, then opened it.
Crow, still there?
Yes. Nut just came back with some juice for Barry. He's got a bad sore throat.
Try this, Walnut said to Barry, unscrewing the cap. It's apple, still cold from the cooler. It'll soothe your gullet something grand.
Barry got up on his elbows and gulped when Nut tipped the small glass bottle to his lips.
Crow found it hard to look at. He'd seen baby lambs drink from nursing bottles in that same weak, I can't do it myself way.
Can he talk, Crow? If he can, give him the phone.
Crow elbowed Jimmy aside and sat down beside Barry.
Rose, she wants to talk to you.
He attempted to hold the phone next to Barry's ear, but the chink took it from him. Either the juice or the aspirin Nut had made him swallow seemed to have given him some strength.
Rose, he croaked. Sorry about this, darling.
He listened, nodding.
I know. I get that.
He listened some more.
No, not yet, but... Yeah. I can. I will. Yeah. I love you, too. Here he is.
He handed the phone to Crow, then collapsed back onto the stacked pillows, his temporary burst of strength exhausted.
I'm here, Crow said.
Has he started cycling yet?
Crow glanced at Barry.
No.
Thank God for small favors. He says he can still locate her. I hope he's right. If he can't, you'll have to find her yourselves. We have to have that girl.
Crow knew she wanted the kid. Maybe Julianne, maybe Emma, probably Abra, for her own reasons, and for him that was enough, but there was more at stake. Maybe the true's continued survival. In a whispered consultation at the back of the Winnebago, Nut had told Crow that the girl had probably never had the measles, but her steam might still serve to protect them because of the inoculation she would have been given as a baby. It wasn't a sure bet, but a hell of a lot better than no bet at all.
Crow, talk to me, honey.
We'll find her.
He shot the true's computer maven a look.
Jimmy's got it narrowed down to three possibles, all in one block radius. We've got pictures.
That's excellent.
She paused, and when she spoke again, her voice was lower, warmer, and perhaps the slightest bit shaky. Crow hated the idea of Rose being afraid, but he thought she was. Not for herself, but for the true Nut it was her duty to protect.
You know, I'd never send you on with Barry sick if I didn't think it was absolutely vital.
Yeah.
Get her. Knock her the fuck out. Bring her back. Okay?
Okay.
If the rest of you get sick, if you feel you have to charter a jet and fly her back...
We'll do that, too. But Crow dreaded the prospect. Any of them not sick when they got on the plane would be when they got off. Equilibrium shot, hearing screwed blue for a month or more, palsy, vomiting, and of course flying left a paper trail. Not good for passengers escorting a drugged and kidnapped little girl. Still, needs must when the devil drives.
Time you got back on the road, Rose said. You take care of my Barry, big man. The rest of them, too.
Is everyone okay at your end?
Sure, Rose said, and hung up before he could ask her anything else.
That was okay. Sometimes you didn't need telepathy to tell when someone was lying. Even the rubes knew that.
He tossed the phone on the table and clapped his hands briskly.
Okay, let's gas and go. Next stop, Sturbridge, Massachusetts. Nut, you stick with Barry. I'll drive the next 6 hours. Then you're up, Jimmy.
I want to go home, Jimmy Numbers said morosely. He was about to say more, but a hot hand grabbed his wrist before he could.
We got no choice about this, Barry said.
His eyes were glittering with fever, but they were sane and aware. In that moment, Crow was very proud of him.
No choice at all, computer boy. So man up. True comes first. always.
Crow sat down behind the wheel and turned the key. Jimmy, he said, sit with me a minute. Want to have a little gab. Jimmy Numbers sat down in the passenger seat. These three girls, how old are they? Do you know?
That and a lot of other stuff. I hacked their school records when I got the pictures. In for a penny, in for a pound, right? Dean and Cross are 14. The Stone girl is a year younger. She skipped a grade in elementary school.
I find that suggestive of steam, Crow said.
Yeah.
And they all live in the same neighborhood.
Right.
I find that suggestive of chumminess. Jimmy's eyes were still swollen with tears, but he laughed.
Yeah, girls, you know. All three of them probably wear the same lipstick and moan over the same bands. What's your point?
No point, Crow said. Just information. Information is power, or so they say. 2 minutes later, Steamhead Steve's Bago was merging back onto Interstate 90. When the speedometer was pegged at 65, Crow put on the cruise control and let it ride.
7. Dan outlined what he had in mind, then waited for Dave Stone to respond. For a long time, he only sat beside Abra with his head lowered and his hands clasped between his knees.
Daddy? Abra asked. Please say something.
Dave looked up and said,
Who wants a beer?
Dan and John exchanged a brief bemused glance and declined.
Well, I do. What I really want is a double shot of Jack, but I'm willing to stipulate with no input from you gentlemen that sipping whiskey might not be such a good idea tonight.
I'll get it, Dad.
Abra bounced into the kitchen. They heard the snap of the flip-top and the hiss of the carbonation, sounds that brought back memories for Dan, many of them treacherously happy. She returned with a can of Coors and a Pilsner glass.
Can I pour it?
Knock yourself out.
Dan and John watched with silent fascination as Abra tilted the glass and slid the beer down the side to minimize the foam, operating with the casual expertise of a good bartender. She handed the glass to her father and set the can on a coaster beside him. Dave took a deep swallow, sighed, closed his eyes, then opened them again.
That's good, he said.
I bet it is, Dan thought, and saw Abra watching him. Her face, usually so open, was inscrutable, and for the moment he could not read the thoughts behind it.
Dave said, What you're proposing is crazy, but it has its attractions. Chief among them would be a chance to see these creatures with my own eyes. I think I need to because, in spite of everything you've told me, I find it impossible to believe in them, even with the glove and the body you say you found.
Abra opened her mouth to speak. Her father stayed her with a raised hand.
I believe that you believe, he went on, all three of you, and I believe that some group of dangerously deranged individuals might, I say might, be after my daughter. I'd certainly go along with your idea, Mr. Torrance, if it didn't mean bringing Abra. I won't use my kid as bait.
You wouldn't have to, Dan said. He was remembering how Abra's presence in the loading dock area behind the ethanol plant had turned him into a kind of human cadaver dog, and the way his vision had sharpened when Abra opened her eyes inside his head. He had even cried her tears, although a DNA test might not have shown it.
What do you mean?
Your daughter doesn't have to be with us to be with us. She's unique that way. Abra, do you have a friend you could visit tomorrow after school? Maybe even stay with overnight?
Sure, Emma Dean.
He could see by the excited sparkle in her eyes that she already understood what he had in mind.
Bad idea, Dave said. I won't leave her unguarded.
Abra was being guarded all the time we were in Iowa, John said. Abra's eyebrows shot up and her mouth dropped open a little. Dan was glad to see this,
He was sure she could have picked his brain any old time she wanted to, but she had done as he asked. Dan took out his cell and speed dialed. "Billy, why don't you come on in here and join the party?" 3 minutes later, Billy Freeman stepped into the Stonehouse. He was wearing jeans, a red flannel shirt with tails hanging almost to his knees, and a teeny town railroad cap, which he doffed before shaking hands with Dave and Abra.
"You helped him with his stomach," Abra said, turning to Dan. "I remember that."
"You've been picking my brains after all," Dan said. She flushed.
"Not on purpose. Never. Sometimes it just happens."
"Don't I know it?"
"All respect to you, Mr. Freeman," Dave said, "but you're a little old for bodyguard duty, and this is my daughter we're talking about."
Billy raised his shirt tails and revealed an automatic pistol in a battered black holster.
1911 Colt, he said. "Full auto. World War II vintage. This is old too, but it'll do the job."
"Abra," John asked, "do you think bullets can kill these things, or is it only childhood diseases?"
Abra was looking at the gun. "Oh, yes," she said. "Bullets would work. They're not ghosty people. They're as real as we are."
John looked at Dan and said, "I don't suppose you have a gun." Dan shook his head and looked at Billy.
"I've got a deer rifle I could loan you," Billy said.
"That might not be good enough," Dan said. Billy considered.
"Okay. I know a guy down in Madison. He buys and sells bigger stuff. Some of it much bigger."
"Oh, Jesus," Dave said. "This just gets worse." But he didn't say anything else. Dan said, "Billy, could we reserve the train tomorrow if we wanted to have a sunset picnic at Cloud Gap?"
"Sure. People do it all the time, especially after Labor Day, when the rates go down."
Abra smiled. It was one Dan had seen before. It was her angry smile. He wondered if the True Knot might have had second thoughts if they knew their target had a smile like that in her repertoire. "Good," she said. "Good."
"Abra?" Dave looked bewildered and a little frightened.
"What?"
Abra ignored him for the moment. It was Dan she spoke to.
"They deserve it for what they did to the baseball boy."
She wiped at her mouth with a cupped hand as if to erase that smile. But when she pulled the hand away, the smile was still there, her thinned lips showing the tips of her teeth. She clenched the hand into a fist. "They deserve it." Part 3. Matters of Life and Death. Chapter 13. Cloud Gap. 1. Easy Mail Services was in a strip mall between a Starbucks and O'Reilly Auto Parts. Crow entered just after 10 a.m., presented his Henry Rothman ID, signed for a package the size of a shoebox, and walked back out with it under his arm. In spite of the air conditioning, the Winnebago was rank with the stench of Barry's sickness, but they had grown used to it and hardly smelled it at all. The box bore the return address of a plumbing supply company in Flushing, New York. There actually was such a company, but it had had no hand in this particular delivery. Crow, Snake, and Jimmy Numbers watched as Nut sliced the tape with his Swiss Army knife and lifted the flaps. He pulled out a wad of inflated plastic packing, then a double fold of cotton fluff. Beneath it, set in styrofoam, was a large, unlabeled bottle of straw-colored fluid, 8 syringes, 8 darts, and a skeletal pistol.
"Holy shit! There's enough stuff there to send her whole class to Middle Earth," Jimmy said.
"Rose has a great deal of respect for this little chiquita," Crow said.
He took the tranquilizer gun out of its styrofoam cradle, examined it, put it back. "We will, too."
"Crow!"
Barry's voice was clotted and hoarse.
"Come here!"
Crow left the contents of the box to Walnut and went to the man sweating on the bed. Barry was now covered with hundreds of bright red blemishes.
his eyes swollen almost shut, his hair matted to his forehead. Crow could feel the fever baking off him, but the chink was a hell of a lot stronger than Grandpa Flick had been. He still wasn't cycling.